Oi, oi, it's your boy, Slacky J, coming at you on the 2nd of September. After my usual morning health scare, I woke up and I was like, oh my god, I'm really sore, do I have appendicitis? And then I remembered that I was rolling with a massive dude the other day, who he was one of those guys who didn't really know how to deal with closed guard, so he just sort of like postured up and put his hands like deep into my belly. And then I'd break him down and start attacking him, and then he'd posture up again. So probably just bruising, but if you don't hear from me, you know, I'll have appendicitis. But what have we got going on this weekend? The answer is little bits of things and then not so much. In each card going on this weekend, there's not a lot going on, but there's a couple of interesting things happening across several cards. You got one card's worth of content across multiple organizations. So honestly, don't know how long I'm going to be able to get out of this this UFC card and some of the other interesting fights going on. But we'll ramble for a bit and then we'll do some questions. And then if worst comes to worst, I'll work off the rest of the time by talking about Psychonauts 2 and Twin Peaks, the two things that I've been binging this week. I never did my full Sopranos review. I'm going to have to do that. I'll do a Patreon episode where I'm just like, how good was the Sopranos? And then all the comments can be like, have you seen The Wire yet, Jack? So anyway, this weekend we have a thoroughly cursed card. In part because it was supposed to be in London, I believe, and then they had to move it. I'm not sure why, because there are events going on in the UK now. So yeah, I mean, don't know what happened there. But that would explain why you've got, you know, your Darren Till main event, Tom Aspinall co-main event, Paddy Pimblett making his UFC debut, Molly McCann, and Jack Shaw on the card. But there were also a heap of cancellations. Like, Nathaniel Wood was supposed to be on the card. He's withdrawn. Lerone Murphy, he's also, he had visa issues. Alexander Gustafsson versus Paul Craig is off because Gustafsson's injured. And then you've got, hold on this card, Tom Aspinall, David Zawada, Jonathan Martinez, Charles Jourdain, and Jack Shaw were all supposed to be fighting other people. So this is a card made up of last-minute swap-outs. So on the one hand, that's kind of like, oh, a bit weird. But on the other hand, that's, I don't know, opportunity for chaos to happen. Most often when you get 2-3 months to train and it's the best versus the better guy or the better prepared guy will win. Whereas if you switch everyone's opponent at the last minute, you never know what's going to happen. Oh, I'm on the breakfast tea because we ran out of Earl Grey. And it's rank, if I'm honest. But yes, main event talk. Let's go. I've been putting it off because there isn't an awful lot to say. It's, you know, a couple of ultimate meme fighters. I mean, to be fair to Derek Brunson, he's on a little run right now. 4 wins, no defeats in that time. Theodoru, Heinich, Shabazian, Holland. I suppose the one that everyone really cares about is Shabazian in that one because the others are not huge names. And then Kevin Holland. I'm just going to throw it out there. I said it on Twitter, but if I'm studying film for someone, I don't count wrestling Kevin Holland. he's so fucking bad at stopping takedowns that, you know, that Derek Brunson fight barely counts. It's a blip on the radar of Derek Brunson's career. Same is true of Marvin Vettori's fight with Kevin Holland. It's like taking down Curtis Millender. It's just unfair. But yes, undefeated going back to the loss to Israel Adesanya in November 2018. So honestly, Brunson's on the up and up. Darren Till, meanwhile, has the most underailable hype train ever built because he's won one fight since like 2018 and people are still hype on him. He's still in a main event. I mean, it helps that he's a bit of a memeable character. He's a funny lad. But, you know, he got absolutely blown out by Tyron Woodley in September 2018. Did decently against Jorge Masvidal, but got caught and knocked out flat 2019. Came back and fought Kelvin Gastelum and actually put in a good performance, but won a split decision. And then lost to Robert Whittaker. So, you know, he's kind of in the same situation as Kelvin Gastelum, except he's beaten Kelvin Gastelum, which is like, people go, well, I can see how good he could be, so a win over him still matters, but his record just isn't looking great in recent years. Both of these guys, extremely strange styles. Derek Brunson, you know, until recently, was just like running chin first. Like his chin literally looked up at the ring lights. It's incredible. And that was his thing, and sort of trying to overwhelm people. Very explosive, but not very slick is how I'd describe it. Whereas Darren Till, I think those same two words could also be used to describe him. He's a bit different as a fighter, but very explosive, not very slick. There was always this talk about like his power at welterweight, and he never really got the stoppages to back it up. But what Darren Till always had was ridiculous speed, especially for a man as big as he was at welterweight. It should have been illegal what he was doing, but blindingly fast. Not a great combination puncher, not a great combination striker, doesn't really throw combinations, only really has the left straight. But one instant it's by his chin, and the next instant it's by the other guy's chin, and he's falling over. If you know, at all doubt how fucking fast he is, go watch the fight with Jorge Masvidal. Masvidal, one, doesn't like tall people, long people. Two, doesn't really like southpaws. And Darren Till was just finding his chin pretty flawlessly through the early going. But he has a lot of big flaws on the defensive end. The chin always way up in the air. And that's how you know he's got a really good chin, because he gets hit on the chin a lot and doesn't get knocked out an awful lot. The Woodley performance is probably the one that matters most here, because it's sort of Darren Till at his worst. And it's also the if Brunson's going to paralyze him, this is the way that Brunson's going to paralyze him. Tyron Woodley beat Darren Till by ducking into the clinch whenever Till came close enough and threatening the takedown. And then the way that Darren Till's striking works is flappy, flappy hands and then a good left straight. You can watch any of the sparring footage of him with like bigger lads. You can watch any of his fights. But yeah, he waves his hands around erratically, feinting, and then he throws his left straight, and it's very, very quick. But he doesn't have any setups. There are no throwaway punches, so everything he throws is either real or not thrown, which is why through the first round against Tyron Woodley, he threw zero strikes. He only showed feints. And then he went back to his corner, and they were like, you need to throw some fucking strikes. Comes out for the second round, no feints, just runs straight out and throws a left straight, and Woodley has no bother at all timing a pull counter, because there's nothing to confuse him. It's interesting because like before Woodley, almost all of Darren Till's wins have aged terribly, because they're all people who were in the UFC for like two fights, and one of them was losing to Darren Till, with the exception of Nicholas Dalby, who went out of the UFC and came back, but that was a very close fight. But yeah, basically Darren Till's wins have aged about as well as wins over BJ Penn or Tyron Woodley. And that loss to Tyron Woodley is where he aged even worse, because he's the last person Tyron Woodley looked good against. With that being said, I'm going to bring it back round to the Kelvin Gastelum fight, because I was really impressed by that. I thought he looked really good. I thought he was striking he was fighting generally in a way that really favoured his skill set. Circling off, playing the counterfighter, keeping it to one-at-a-time exchanges, which, you know, against Kelvin Gastelum is pretty important, because Kelvin Gastelum catches so many guys after they've hit him on his iron head. He'll blindside them with a left swing, you know. That was also a fight where Till brought out the intercepting knee, which was something we hadn't seen a lot from him before, and used the clinch to smother any of Gastelum's combination work. And that Gastelum fight's also pretty important, because it's the last southpaw that Darren Till faced. And in this matchup, you know, Till versus Brunson, it's southpaw versus southpaw. Now, for Brunson's part, the career resurgence, I mean, it's four-fight winning streak, but the career resurgence basically hinges around the win over Edmund Shahbazyan, because that was the one where he actually looked good, and we all went, damn, Derek Brunson's put it together now, and now we've not seen that since that fight, because he fought Kevin Holland, got slapped a couple of times, but basically took effortless takedowns for, was it five rounds? So it's been a while, but might as well recap what I liked he was doing against Edmund Shahbazyan, which was striking effectively into takedowns and using the threat of the takedown to set up more strikes. Doesn't sound that hard, but it's taken him a whole career to work it out. The chin was down a bit more, still comically up in the air, but down a bit more. And he was throwing lots of lovely left high kicks and left straights and using those to get into level changes. And he was actually closing down the distance before he struck, which is the most important thing, because like that, Derek Brunson has been sort of a caricature of that, but actually stepping in and tightening the distance is something that's so lacking in MMA, because, you know, everyone goes, oh, it's fought from a further distance out, blah, blah, blah. Which, yeah, to an extent is true. If you've got the risk of takedowns, you want a little bit, you want more of a buffer zone to react. But if you're a strong wrestler and everyone's expecting the takedown out of you, even more reason to close the distance down and apply some pressure, because every time you get closer to the opponent, they're going to freak out because you're taking away their buffer zone, their Bruce buffer zone. You're telling them it's time. But even like Mayweather versus McGregor, the pressure in that fight is not pressure in like a ring-cutting, inscrutable pressure kind of performance. The pressure is that Floyd Mayweather just keeps walking up into range, and McGregor has made a career out of people lunging from too far out. So, yeah, he just got exhausted recorrecting the distance each time to try and get back to the distance he was comfortable with. I mean, we're going to be talking about like Tom Aspinall later and just how much people suck at closing the distance in this sport. But if you walk in like to the point where you're uncomfortably too close, that's the distance that makes people uncomfortable. And that's what Derek Brunson was doing really well against Edmund Shahbazyan. You know, and that's, if you're the wrestler, you've got the luxury, because if one of you ducks or the other one ducks or someone misses and you fall into a chest-to-chest clinch and you're the really strong wrestler, that's, you are the one winning there. You've got an effective threat applied against them. But more than that, by closing that distance down over and over again, those high kicks come up really fast. The left straight that Brunson was landing over and over again, or throwing over and over again, is a real problem. Guys have to overreact to it. They have to work in a smaller space, and you could drop onto their hips afterwards, which is what Brunson was able to do against Shahbazyan. Now, Shahbazyan is a decent hitter, but you know, he was also pretty famous for just having like big, long kicks and high kicks and things that he threw up, and so pressuring him down in that way was probably a great shout. I don't know if he had the same threat of the counterpunch as Till, because Till is so quick. So really, like, that's the question for me at the start of this fight is, will Brunson be happy walking up to Darren Till? If he can keep walking up to him and pressuring him and threatening to get chest to chest with him, I think Darren Till could be in for a long night. And it also sort of dictates what kind of Darren Till we see. Because I've seen him do two different things. You know, I've seen him do the pressure fighting, which is what he was doing when he was just blowing through the guys who are no longer in the UFC, but like just walking him down and smashing him. Or, Donald Cerrone, that was a horrible stylistic matchup for Donald Cerrone. Someone was telling me that Till read my articles for that fight, which is good. But that fight between Till and Cerrone, Till just walks him to the fence immediately, puts him under pressure and snipes him. But he can do the same thing on the back foot now. Like he was doing it against Kelvin Gastelum. He was trying to do it to a degree against Whittaker at points, but less successfully because, again, Whittaker is also so fast in his own right and has a much deeper bag of tools. Did stop 75% of takedown attempts from Whittaker in that fight, though, which was pretty good. But yes, I mean, Darren Till, limited skill set in terms of like the tools he uses, but that just means that he can do it in two different ways. He can go forward doing it and go backwards doing it. And that's useful, and I suspect it's going to be important here, because if he goes forward and pressures Derek Brunson and Brunson gets scared, you're going to see Brunson running in and out. You're going to see Brunson taking bad shots. And you're probably going to see Brunson get hurt with counterpunches. But if Derek Brunson comes out and is like, I will comfortably just fall chest to chest with you if you keep walking forwards, and Brunson puts him on the back foot, it'll be interesting to see how that fight plays out. Now, in the Southpaw versus Southpaw matchup, you'd expect the left hand could be taken away a bit by Brunson, just by carrying the lead hand high. You know, normally we say the line of the shoulder is the important thing, because the line, you know, if you want a shoulder roll when you're in the same stance as the opponent, it's their rear hand that's firing onto your shoulder. So if you're throwing like naked rear hands at a good boxer, it's probably not going to work. But for people who can't shoulder roll, picking up the lead arm, answering the telephone, you know, putting the elbow up there or the forearm, all on the same line as the shoulder, but up towards the head, makes it very hard to land straight blows too, off the rear hand, that is. So if you're Brunson, you know, just answer the telephone every time you think that the left hand's coming, or just stand there with it up. You know, you don't use your jab much. Right hand, it would be against the Southpaw, as a Southpaw. But that Southpaw versus Southpaw matchup takes away a couple of the nice tools that I would like to see Derek Brunson using. I can't remember, was Shahbazyan Southpaw or Orthodox? Does he switch? At any rate, like a couple of these tricks were things that Brunson used against him. Not impossible, but throwing the high kick to the opponent's rear arm, because you know that either like you're keeping their hand at home, or as soon as they feel comfortable having blocked it, they're going to throw back. So high kick straight into the level change. And when you're in an open guard stance, southpaw versus orthodox, you can throw the left straight down the center and poke your head out the side and drop onto quick takedowns. The Mads Bernal special, but a little bit trickier against an opponent in the same stance. But again, Mads Bernal does it against people who are. But then Mads Bernal, like, how many middleweights do you think are in the same caliber of fighter as Mads Bernal? Anyway, yes, I think speed is probably going to be a big factor here. Darren Till's speed. And how well Brunson can take a shot. How well he can, and how well he can work when he's been dinged. Because I feel like most of us are expecting Derek Brunson to get chinned fairly early, and then how he reacts to that will dictate how the fight goes. Well, that's that one out of the way. Quite quickly. Let's get on to the rest of this desperate card then. In the co-main event, you got Tom Aspinall versus Sergey Spivak. Originally, Tom Aspinall versus Sergey Pavlovich, and they just found another Sergey because Pavlovich had visa issues. Bit of a shame because Pavlovich is a fun boxer. Very, very long reach. Got like an 80, 90 inch reach. And decent hands. Which would have been a fun pairing with Tom Aspinall and his striking chops. But instead we get Tom Aspinall versus Sergey Spivak. Not a great striker, but a good smothering top player. And with any up and coming heavyweight, they could well get scarf holded for 15 minutes at some point. So there's some intrigue, if not as much intrigue as the Pavlovich fight. I think Pavlovich is lower ranked than Spivak, though, so this might work out better for Aspinall. Though the rankings are made up, and you know, who knows what's going on with that. So Aspinall's coming off the win over Andrei Orlovsky back in February. Before that, knocked out Jake Collier with like the second punch thrown, and Alan Badeau in October 2020. The Badeau fight is hilarious because he's from, I think he's from Fight Factory Paris, but he's from some French gym. And at the beginning, the commentator's like, oh, well, Badeau knows what he's prepared for here. They've prepared for Tom Aspinall several times before. And while they're saying it, Badeau is just trying to time spinning backfists every time Aspinall steps in, and it's never working. Fucking awful game plan. I mean, it might not have been a game plan, might have just gone out and done something stupid, but to repeatedly try and spinning backfist someone in round one. And I think that's part of what Aspinall's appeal is. It's, you know, when you're dealing with like heavyweight prospects, you can have like the Travis Browns where you're like, damn, this dude's so big and athletic and look how easily he elbowed those dudes in the head with the elbows, which about 50% of them were legal. Or, hey, look, Greg Hardy, he's massive. He was in the NFL and so on. But with people like Garn and Aspinall, you get to see like guys who are competent fighters who also happen to be really big. And that's probably the best base for being a heavyweight. Be a competent fighter first and just happen to be 230 pounds plus. And the reason I keep drawing up the Garn comparison is that both men are people who know where they need to be. And when the opponent's coming into attack, they're not there. And it's especially obvious when you watch Aspinall fight. Like, there is stuff that isn't ideal, and you would get punished for it in lower weight classes against good opposition. Just the way that he runs backwards on straight lines. Like, him and Garn both like to drop away from the opponent and create distance, but Aspinall really does love running backwards on a straight line. If you watch him against Arlovsky's running forward, pumping hands, and it's just the most... it's a terrible strategy, because, like, half of Aspinall's game plan is to swipe you from the side, whether it's like a left hook or a right sort of slappy hook punch as you're running in after him. But like Andrei Arlovsky's just doing like no hope work, and Aspinall's still running himself onto the fence, especially once he gassed himself out with that first round flurry. His footwork was just like, he's reacting to the dude, but he's not reacting to where he is in the cage. And if someone's going to, you know, really stick it to Tom Aspinall, I will tell you the way to do it now. Pump hands, run up into low kicks, because it's the trailing leg. It's always the last thing leaving range. It's Shogun Machida 1. It's right there for him. It's just that heavyweights are not very good. With that being said, Aspinall's very good. I mean, I think he's a terrific striker. His timing is excellent. His anticipation is really good. Like, I was watching some of his Cage Warriors work, and there was a great little sequence. He was backing people onto the fence more back then. He seems to be doing more floaty work out in the open. I think Cage Warriors might use a slightly smaller cage. But he was backing guys onto the cage in Cage Warriors. and he'd throw like a 1-2-3, and on the three he'd lean back and just make enough distance that the opponent's punch fell short. Really lovely stuff. He hit this guy with a 1-2-3 along the fence, and then he jumped in behind the three again, so the guy's right hand came up and he shot a right straight down the center, the old left hook right straight Mark Hunt favorite. And the intercepting knee he hit on Collier was great. You know, just backed up, let Collier come forward, hit him with a knee, punched him in the face immediately afterwards. I mean, we saw the value of that the other day with Giga Chukwudze. If you hit a guy with a kick or a knee to the body or the arm, immediately punch them in the face. don't wait. Just punch him in the face right away. So yes, I mean, the one takeaway from his UFC career so far is that he went apeshit on Arlovsky and, you know, I want to say gassed himself out, but he did recover from it. So, he got a second wind, but he really had to slow down through the later first round and much of the second. Now, in Spivak, he's fighting someone interesting because Spivak will put himself on the fence. And I was watching, I think it might have been the other French lad that he fought in Cage Warriors, Aspinall this is, and he worked him along the fence, and just as he was starting to tee off on this dude ducks and overhands him and hits him dead to rights as he's coming in. And then I watched a load of Sergei Spivak's fights, and wouldn't you know it, the last one that wasn't Alexei Oleinik, it was some other schlub. But he hit him with exactly the same thing. He went to the fence, the guy came in, he hit him with an overhand right, and then he ducked in on his legs and took him down. Be interested to see if he can do that against Tom Aspinall. Obviously, Aspinall's feet are a lot quicker than that lad. And he puts people on the fence with the intention of going back away from them, dropping back to the middle of the cage, Conor McGregor style. So I'm not actually that concerned about that. I think the real concern here for Aspinall is just getting, like, women's MMA thrown. Like, that's what Sergei Spivak's talent seems to be. Like, he did it to Taito Ivasa, just grabbed him in the clinch, hoofed him over with an ugly Haraguchi, and sat in a scarf hold. Those are the takedowns he's going to have more effect attempting, I imagine, because all he has to do is stick to Tom Aspinall when Tom Aspinall comes in. He doesn't have to get under him. Side note, Tom Aspinall has a Charlie Kirk face. He got the margins set on wide. Very small face in the middle. And when he's got the little Spartan beard and moustache, it makes it more obvious. But yes, excited for more of him. Always excited to watch Spivak lose or look bad winning. And then laugh at people who said that either Rampage or Fedor could beat Sergei Spivak. Immediately before their fight, some guy was telling me that. So, other stuff on this card. I suppose the other big story is the arrival of Paddy Pimblett, who we've been waiting for a little while. Massive fan favourite in Cage Warriors, massive fan favourite in Liverpool. If you watch any of those fights where they did a Pimblett main event in Liverpool, the crowd are just going bonkers anytime Paddy does anything. Like against against Nad Nirimani. Like, he's getting his ass kicked and he works back to half guard and the crowd goes bonkers. He's an interesting fellow because, like, he's known for his grappling, but he got submitted in a Polaris match against Stevie Ray, of all people, very recently. But really what he does is get people down with scrambly grappling exchanges and then beats the tar out of them from top position. The big weakness in his game is and always has been the striking. He's very, very herky-jerky. He stands with his back to the fence, which is a bad start. Like, if you watch the fights against Soren Beck and Nad Nirimani, both of them have great success just by backing him onto the fence and beating him up there. But he throws his jab like he really wants to see if it lands. So, like, he'll reach out with his jab, lean forward and stick his chin up so he can just, like, looking over the top of his opponent's guard to try and see if the jab gets in. Whereas if you watch someone who's really good at throwing their jab away and using their jab as a weapon in MMA, they tend to throw the jab separate to the rest of their body, which is defensively configured, you know. And then he throws, like, lots of jumpy switch kicks and things like that that just don't do much. My main criticism of Paddy on the feet is that he doesn't have anything to hurt people. And when he does, like, when he does commit to a right hand, immediately, like, it's a big uppercut and people drop on his hips and just take him down or whatever, or counter him because his head's up in the air. And the commentators have a discussion about whether, was that a really bad connection or is Paddy's hair making it look worse because his hair flies everywhere? I mean, that's an old pro wrestling trick. If you've got long hair when you sell a punch, it looks amazing. But he does also get cracked way out of position all the time. What he's very good at, like particularly in those fights with Soren Beck and Nad Narimani, is like he will grab a single and he will make an ugly, ugly scramble, and it might take him 3 minutes, but he'll get on your back or on top somehow. Very grindy guy. In not like the American wrestler sort of grindy way, but just like, I'm happy to sit in this position, like inching forwards. It's up to you if you want to change the position. And then when the opponent tries to make something happen, he gets on their back. Often wears the Sakuraba shorts, and he's a big fan of the Kimura, both from like the turtle and half guard. He's a really fun fighter. Like, I really enjoyed his last couple, where he's just pounded out dudes really quick, or battered dudes really quick, rather. Deki Dalton and David Martinez. But he's been overdue to come to the UFC for a while. It's been, people have talked about it for a while. Like, Nad Narimani, when Nad Narimani beat Paddy, he immediately jumped into the UFC. When Soren Beck beat him, I think he got a title shot at, like, I think he fought Morgan Charrier, and then he went to Bellator. But, like, dudes who beat him are ready to move on from Cage Warriors, and Paddy should have probably a while ago. And it's going to be one of those interesting discussions, like, did he benefit from having longer with the lower level of competition, or did he suffer because he was, you know, because he missed some key years when he would have been in the Shark Tank with the really badass dudes? But they've given him a fairly, like, pedestrian step up here in Luigi Vendramini, who is 1-2 in the UFC. One of the losses was a majority decision, so close stuff, but the only other big loss was Zaleski Dos Santos knocked him out with a flying knee. So it'll be intriguing to see what he does. He's already made a lot of enemies by pointing out that Khabib only fought like three good guys. Oh, we did say we'd do the Jose Aldo versus Khabib discussion. But honestly, like, the reason that Khabib's coming out against Jose Aldo and be like, nothing he did is that special. One, Peter Yan's Russian and he loves Peter Yan. But two, like, if you start talking about how many good people were beaten, yes, Jose Aldo is far higher on the GOAT rankings than Khabib Nurmagomedov. I think I said it before, but Jose Aldo was fighting the best featherweight of all time in 2008 and has been going since then against top fighters every time out. Khabib Nurmagomedov started fighting good fighters in like 2015. But anyway, Paddy pissed some people off with that. So I imagine there'll be lots of people tuning in ready to be like, ha, bum-ass bum, knew he was a bum. But yes, you know, it's just going to be another sort of Cage Warriors crossover. It's like Mason Jones, ton of hype, you know, definitely not the next McGregor, decent enough though. And then other guys just don't make the jump at all. But then other guys are Conor McGregor. So, like, it's, you never really know what you're getting with an ex-Cage Warriors star. So other stuff. Oh, Jack Shaw. He's fighting Ludwig Shaolin. That's a great name for a German martial artist. Unfortunately, he's Ukrainian. But this is a replacement because he was supposed to be fighting Syed Nurmagomedov, which is a really interesting fight between two up-and-comers. Do you know why? Because it's that bantamweight division and everything's just nuts down there. But Shaolin Yan looks like one of those guys who's coming in off who they might have had lined up for the Contender Series and just brought in immediately. Because that's how a lot of these cards are getting made now. But Jack Shaw, yeah, like him. Welsh wrestling, as they say. And it's like, I was thinking about this with Paddy Pimblett earlier. There are, like, the odd, you know, you always watch these fights on the UK scene and you think, like, well, yeah, he's a really good grappler, but he's going to have real trouble when he starts meeting, like, D1 wrestlers. But it's easy to forget that, like, MMA wrestling is a whole different thing. And I think that the UK could be very good at that if they put time and effort into it. Because cage wrestling is the, like, if you did what was that awful show where they went around? The big guy and Jason Thingy from 10th Planet. Ultimate Warrior? No, Ultimate Weapon? Ultimate Martial Art? I forget, they used to go around and, like, talk to various martial artists and they'd do, like, two techniques from that style and be like, this is typical of the so-and-so style. If you did one for MMA, as much as it isn't a style, but if you did one for MMA, cage wrestling would be it. It's the thing that makes MMA MMA. And there have been guys who don't have wrestling pedigrees, but are very good at cage wrestling, and they come out of Britain. A great example is Brad Pickett. You know, One Punch was a misnomer. He called himself that so that people wouldn't mind getting into wrestling matches with him. But very, very strong wrestler in MMA. I think wrestling is a great base for getting into MMA when we're talking about, like, people who are coming from lots of different martial arts, like, everyone would get into MMA. But now that you can start MMA from an early age, I think cage wrestling is going to become more and more different from regular wrestling. You know, half the stuff in regular wrestling is creating openings on people who are bent over at the waist and touching your head. Or, you know, in Greco, like walking up to people with their elbows flush to their sides and trying to poke each other's biceps with your hands. But yes, Jack Shore, last one, got the split decision over Hunter Azure. I like Hunter Azure. He's cool. But he's now 3-0 in the UFC. Two finishes, beat Aaron Phillips and Nohelin Hernandez, both by rear naked choke. Very smothering grappler. That Nurmagomedov fight would have been fun, damn. But he's had two switches of opponents since then. Like, he had Nurmagomedov drop out. He had a guy called Lazishvili, the Lazishvili of touching a wheelie. He pulled out too. So, yeah, two opponent switch-ups. So either Jack Shaw runs through some guy who's not on the level that we expect, or Jack Shaw gets smoked because he doesn't have any idea what he's dealing with here. So, yeah, tune in for that. And then there's some other, you know, Jonathan Martinez had a last-minute replacement. Charles Jourdain versus Julian Arosa, both fun fighters. That's about all I have to say about that fight. It'll be fun. Molly McCann versus Ji-Yun Kim. Yeah. And then Khalil Rountree is going to fight Modestus Bukauskas, and hopefully Modestus Bukauskas, that's what I'm calling him now. And I searched on Twitter to make sure no one had ever thought of that, and I'm very clever. But hopefully Bukauskas doesn't touch his legs, because that's how Khalil Rountree loses. If anyone ever touches his legs, he just falls over. It's amazing. People like him and, well, mainly him, but like clearly athletic specimens in one aspect of the game. So explosive and powerful in one aspect on the feet. And then you touch his legs and he doesn't know anything about wrestling. He can't learn it. Just crazy. Anyway, that's that bollocks card in the rearview mirror. Other fun stuff going on this weekend. Bader Harry's back fighting someone who's not Rico Verhoeven. So that's a nice break with the tradition of the last 4 years. Plug for Advanced Striking 2.0 at Bader Harry, if you've not read that one. Roberto Soldic is fighting on the KSW card. He's like a little crow cop. There's a Filthy Casuals guide to him on the YouTube. And then in one championship, they're doing I think it's their 100th card or something like that, for their 10-year anniversary or something like that. They're doing a card called Empower, which is all women, which is interesting enough. But they got main event is Zhong Jingnan versus Michelle Nicolini. Good fight. This is how fucked up one's women's divisions are. Because Michelle Nicolini, in 2019, she beat Angela Lee for a shot at Zhong Jingnan for a title. But Zhong Jingnan had two belts. So they just had Angela Lee immediately challenged for the other one. Coming off the loss to Michelle Nicolini. So Michelle Nicolini's been out for like 2 years now, but she's really fun as a grappler. Like, as a grappler in a traditional sense, like, she was amazing in the gi. She did well in no gi. I think she might be too small for ADCC, but I feel like she did compete there. I don't know. But she was like Miss Toehold. She toeholded a lot of bitches. But yeah, if you watch her fight with Angela Lee, really smooth stuff. Like, Angela Lee's fouling her five times a second. And Olivia Coste just like, I can't see it. But Michelle Nicolini just works through it. Like, she's getting elbowed in the back of the head. She's just coming up on half guard, rolling through underneath her, making stuff happen. Really incredible grappler. Very technical. And one, she's definitely like a grappler's grappler. She's one that you always hear like Ryan Hall or Keenan Cornelius or people like that talking about and saying like, oh, I got this technique from Michelle Nicolini. But I think she's like 37, 38 now, so she's getting long in the tooth for a combat sports athlete. Meanwhile, Zhong Jingnan, fun Chinese striker. Yeah, not buying into the, like, basically when Weili Zhang won her belt, Zhang Weili, whatever, people were like, well, that's two Chinese fighters at the top of the heap now. one in the UFC, but they're probably levels apart. Zhong Jingnan is basically just a jab and an overhand and the odd left body kick, which is really successful. But like, if you watched her last one against Tiffany Teo basically didn't know how to strike and still got like a 5-round striking war out of her. So very hit and miss is how I describe Zhong Jingnan, but worth watching nonetheless. And then the other interesting one that I saw on this card was, oh no, they got Siohe Ham, which is a big steal because she's normally Road FC. And then I think she was on loan to Ryzen a little while ago. Big star at Atomweight. People love her. But they managed to get her in to fight Denise Zamboanga, who's from the Philippines. And I could only hope that she's out of Team Lakai, because then CeeHo Heehan can touch her legs and just bundle her over. But also on the card, Stamp Fairtex, probably picking up an easy win over someone that you've never heard of. And Anissa Mexen is a big steal because she was in Glory. She was a staple of their division for a while. It was her and Tiffany Van Soest going back and forward in a trilogy. Very, very talented kickboxer, Muay Thai fighter, whatever you want to call her. But yes, she's got a kickboxing match on this card. And actually, that ties in nicely with the bit of news. We'll do some news now. But Myrtle Groenhart is coming to MMA, which is a really bad sign for Glory. Because, like, just a continuation of, like, Robin Van Roosmaal and people like that threatening to go to MMA because they can't get any money kickboxing. Myrtle Groenhart has, like, 100 professional kickboxing matches. He's fought Nicky Holsken a couple of times. He's fought Cedric Doumbé a couple of times. Like, he's top of the heap contender in that division. He basically trades belts with the champion every few months. But, if he's coming to MMA, that's not a great sign. He's debuting in some regional promotion on October 10th. Watch out for backing people onto the fence and throwing, like, the double pump flying knee, the Groenhart knee, as I call it, because he does it, like, 10 times a fight. If he gets you to the fence, he's going to throw his rear, he's going to pump his rear knee up and then jump in with the left knee. And it allows him to continue in combination. And we really like that in MMA. Get people to the boundary, do something flashy, follow up. Other news, Mario Yamasaki has been talking about coming back to MMA. The title of the article was like, Mario Yamasaki probably won't come back to MMA. And he says, I probably won't come back to MMA. And then the next line, he's like, but I would come back if they asked me. Oh, because he's not worked in, he's not worked as a ref since the Shevchenko, Priscilla Cachoeira fight, which everyone gave him shit for. But it was like, I knew it was going to be this before it happened. You knew it was going to be this before it happened. The UFC booked the mismatch. You know, it's not all on Mario Yamasaki. Yes, he's shit, but at a certain point, if you give a toddler a loaded gun, you know, like, it's not always the toddler's fault entirely. But yeah, I was just thinking about this when I was reading it. Mario Yamasaki, we remember him as like the bumbling ref in MMA, the guy who just never makes the right stoppage. But in jiu-jitsu, he's super legit. Murilo Santana, who is like no gi world champion, gi world champion, amazing guard passer. Good guard player, actually. But BJJ Scout did a 3-part study on him. He became coach of Unity. He made the gym in New York where the Meows train and numerous other like world-class jiu-jitsu players train. He's the captain of one of the best teams in jiu-jitsu now. And he's a black belt under Mario Yamasaki. He'd learned under Mario Yamasaki. It's crazy. So more than just a bumbling, terrible ref. And then my other piece of news was that Laura Sanko got to commentate on Dana White Contender Series, and they made it out like now she's a commentator on the UFC. So you're like, well done. But also, like, I'm not going to watch the Contender Series still. You know, doesn't matter how enjoyable the commentary might be, I'm not going to watch the Contender Series. Right, let's do a couple of questions to hopefully bring us up near the hour mark, because this card's dire. Sorry, guys. Heyo, Slacky. I've seen a few times, brackets most recently with William Knight's recent KO.
There is no such thing as a coincidence.
MMA Twitter arguing over whether or not something is a check hook. What defines a check hook? An advancing opponent, the pivot out, or something else? Thanks and cheers, your Patreon boy, Alex. Yes, William Knight knocked out that schlubby dude who is right. Well, I mean, they both looked schlubby as hell, but William Knight's like a 5'4 heavyweight, and this guy kept hitting him with the right straight to the body, pursued him to the fence, and William Knight hit him with a left hook, like, looking away as the dude came in. And there was much debate over whether it's a check hook or not. The thing with terminology in combat sports is that it's bollocks, largely. In sort of like Japanese martial arts, like judo and karate and things like that, just those two mainly, they are very descriptive and they have specific names for everything. Like the International Judo Federation will, you know, in their 7-hour meetings where they decide how to further make the sport shit for spectators. In their 7-hour meetings where they're like, nobody grabs Teddy Riner's pants ever. They're busy arguing over like the technical definition of what a technique is. I mean, even the sumo, there are 60 or something like, no, it's like 58 finishing techniques in sumo. And if you do something that isn't any of them, they have to define it as one of those things. So it's like, oh, near enough. It was near enough a Sukui Nagi or something like that. But even in like karate, you know, there's a, every time we talk about that inside out round kick that Garn throws and Anderson Silva used against Michael Bisping, every time we talk about it, like in some karate, it's a gyaku morishigeri. Some karate, it's a uchi morishigeri. Some call it, that's a round kick, variously, an inverted round kick or an inside round kick. And some styles call it a different sort of, like a crescent kick of some kind. So even when you try and get your terminology down, like no one will, not everyone's going to agree on it. And it's one of my pet peeves, people like getting angry about terminology online. You're like, fuck it. We know what we're talking about. You know what I'm talking about because I'm showing you a video here. You don't need to correct me. The times that I do make fun of people's terminology is when they just use terms like shovel hook for no reason other than to flex the fact that they've heard the term shovel hook. Like, it might have been a Teach of the Junk post, but just like, Fedor Emelianenko hits an uchimata and follows up with a vicious shovel hook. Like, no, he just threw an uppercut. Like, why is it a shovel hook? Honestly, the number of times you can actually use the term shovel hook are so limited. I might have used it the other day, actually, when I was talking about like keeping the elbow tight on variations of body punches, but that's super in the weed shit. You don't need to use the term shovel hook ever. Which leads us on to boxing, because boxing is full of just bizarre names. Like, if you've ever heard the term Philly Shell, that was invented by Fight Night, the video game. Can't find any trace of it before Fight Night put it in as a style, and they just put the name as Philly Shell. And the funny thing is that it's like, I think it was George Benson called it like the slip and slide or the old willy dilly or something like that, like just some bollocks name. So like the real name wasn't any less bollocks than Philly Shell, but it's crazy that real life boxing commentators and MMA commentators are just repeating what some game programmer put in there as like a placeholder. That's not to say that those commentators don't know anything. That's just to say that like terminology is so loose that when one thing caught on, because more people saw Fight Night than probably saw any single boxing match ever, that's what it was known as. And that's why when people start talking about the Czech hook, I'm very skeptical, because most people, the first time they would have heard the phrase Czech hook was when Floyd Mayweather was like, oh, that's what I got Ricky Hatton with. Oh, it was a Czech hook. I learned it at so-and-so boxing camp when I was 5. So the Czech can be because you're checking the guy as he comes in from the side, which is just a counter left hook. Or the Czech could be because you're pivoting offline. And depending on who you talk to, it's different. I promise you that there are multiple people who you consider to have good, educated views on this stuff who will not agree on what a Czech hook is. And really, it's just the clothesline versus lariat debate from pro wrestling done in MMA. So if you say Czech hook and it's not a check hook, or someone else's definition of a check hook isn't that, doesn't matter. Just say, oh, sorry. Or better yet, roll your eyes and go, you need to get laid. Like you're in a 90s teen comedy. So yeah, I mean, I'd be happy calling it a check hook. It was a mess, but I'd call it a check hook if you want. To me, I normally say he checked him with a counter left hook, because that's true. If you check someone coming in with a left hook, you know, you sideswipe them coming in, it is technically checking them with a left hook, so it could be a check hook. Don't care. Who does? Who care? I'm going to find out that someone I like did care about that a lot. Jack, while watching both the Tommy Fury Anthony Taylor and Jake Paul Woodley fights, I was struck by both MMA fighters' difficulty with lateral movement. While they may not represent the highest level of MMA striking, I think it's fair to say that the concept of ring generalship has been slow to permeate MMA. Obviously, with all the different skill sets integrated, its application would look different than in boxing, but I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on why so few MMA fighters have the real ability to effectively cut off the cage. Sam Alvey's aversion to a fair wage, bless. Your Patreon boy, Doug. I only saw bits of the Taylor one because I'm not going to watch Tommy Fury have a setup match, but yes, it was noticeable. Like, they're in the ring, they were really bad at cutting the ring. Now, obviously, Woodley, his game has never been cutting the ring, but I do think that, like, when we talk about how much harder it is to cut a cage because of just the basic geometry of it, you know, the shallower corners, I think that fighters use that or take that to as an excuse to like not really work on it that well. And maybe coaches aren't working on it that well. Like, if you see it done well in the cage, like Hack Press did it a couple of times, Chris Weidman did it a couple of times, you go, yeah, that's really nice ring cutting. But a lot of the time you won't notice when it's not happening, because I don't think we're at the stage where the ring generalship generally means that it matters that much. You do see the odd fight where they're just circling around the ring in one direction, sorry, the cage in one direction, and you're like, yes, that's very obvious. But mostly at the lower levels, it's still sort of like back and forward on a line, and the circular movement is just sort of like what happens between exchanges. I think when you start seeing more strikers who can do good work against the fence, well, it's basically as guys round out their skill sets more, I think ring position is going to matter a lot more. I mean, I'm not saying it doesn't now, but certainly the ring cutting in MMA is not sensational. With that being said, some people surprise you. Like, I thought Henry Cejudo, who I wouldn't have down as a good ring cutter, and stands so bladed that you'd think it'd be very hard for him to ring cut, did a great job of getting Dominic Cruz exactly where he wanted him along the fence the entire time. Wasn't trying to press him into the fence, but he was just trying to get him with his feet almost level so he could kick that rear leg. Petr Yan is another good ring cutter. I think it's something that has to, like, in a boxing ring, it's still something that you do it knowing that you're going to have to do it again. I think in MMA, there's this sort of attitude where, like, I only need to get him to the fence once and then I can try and take him down for the rest of the round or whatever. So ring cutting is seen as like a A to B sort of thing. Whereas in boxing, if you watch like a great ring cutter, like Julio Cesar Chavez Sr., not the fail son, if you watch him against Hector Camacho, very good defensive ring general, very good floating around the edge sort of guy. You watch Chavez, he cuts the ring, bangs in some shots, and then he lets Camacho work his way out. He lets Camacho sprint off the ropes, and then he does it again because he knows that like he's going to have to do it. Like, he can't keep him there. And at a certain point, it's more effort to try and hold the guy there than to land a few good shots and make him work and get away and then just cut him off again. But there's definitely not enough people. Well, I don't think there's anyone in MMA with that kind of confidence where they're happy to lose the... There's very few guys in MMA who have that kind of confidence that they're able to cut the ring knowing that they're going to lose the guy, happily lose the guy, and then cut him off again. In MMA, it's still very much like, cut the ring, cut the ring, cut the ring. Oh, I've got what I want now. Just stay on his hips. Pursue the takedown forever. Hopefully, we don't have to strike again this round. But I think one of the ways that you could trick fighters into better ring craft is to insist that they only use flashy techniques near the cage, or you teach them to use flashy techniques near the cage. I was watching some old Joe Louis, the white kickboxer, that white kickboxing asshole, as Bruce Lee says in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I was watching some of his old instructionals, and it's amazing some of the things that he says that his team do that are now staples in MMA. Like, he goes, oh, the back kick, we only go to it as like a jumping on the spot counter, or when the opponent is against the ropes or the ring boundary. He says, like, that's when we go for the back kick. And that's when you go for the back kick in MMA. Like, if you watch any good back kicker in MMA, it tends to be along the fence, getting the guy to circle. If you teach guys to do that, if you teach guys to do the fucking, showtime knee, showtime kick, shit like that, they'll work their way to the fence more and more. But yes, there's still a long way for ring craft to go. And I think it's just a case of, like, there is so much to do, because ideally you'd have several rounds of just ring craft, you know, like touch sparring or whatever, but you're just one of you's cutting the ring, one of you's circling out, and then you switch over. But, you know, as low impact as that sounds, there's still more time. It's more time training. And your time training is generally better used on other things at this point. Cheers, Doug. Hello, Jack. I just became a Patreon boy, and I was wondering, what are some ways you would recommend building off the step-up inside low kick? I know Zhang Wei Li will occasionally throw the left hook off the inside low kick, like she did against Tisha Torres. Alexander Volkanovski will throw the overhand and close the door with the left hook. Are there other ways to build off the step-up inside low kick? What type of attacks can you throw after doing a lead leg feint after establishing the inside low kick? That's from James. Cheers, James. Inside low kick, well, I think you've got, like, the obvious one, the Dan Henderson inside low kick right hand. It's still money. If guys pick up their leg to check, you've still got them standing there for the right hand, and you could have a good college try at blasting them with it. I think more... I think the inside low kick, like, it's been used in MMA a bit as, like, a non-kicker's kick. So if you watch Dan Henderson, like, stepping up into the inside low kick... Volkanovski and Zhang Weili are probably the top exponents of it at the moment, and they both use it as like a sharp-shooting point scorer out in the open. And it's interesting because I think everyone expects the calf kick now, so they have a lot of success with the inside low kick. If you watch Pedro Munhoz versus Jose Aldo, I was surprised how easily he landed the inside low kick over and over again. But he didn't go to it enough. Like he'd land it and he'd go, ooh, I better not try that again. But because Aldo was so set up to turn his leg out and take the calf kick, the inside low kick landed quite a lot. But what can you do with the inside low kick? I think people need to look at it more like a kickboxing weapon and look at some of the, like the, well, certainly it's a very Muay Thai sort of weapon, because that's where you see lots of singles and doubles in the kicking game. One of my absolute favorites, and you know, it's become such a thing now that it's so rare in MMA rather that it's now the giga kick. People are amazed by it. But step up inside low kick, put the foot down behind you. Opens up tons of stuff. Well, not only does it open up being on the opposite stance, but step up inside low kick, put the leg down behind you. If the opponent doesn't come in, you throw a left high kick, pound their arm. If the opponent does come in, you intercept them with a left knee. If you watch Will Brooks, actually, this is one of the reasons I was so bummed out about Will Brooks' UFC run, is because he was doing some interesting stuff in it. He was using the inside low kick and stepping back into southpaw. And then if the guy came to him, he'd hit them with the intercepting knee and like try and take him down or just shuck out of the clinch. Or if they stayed there, he'd throw the left high kick or a left front kick. Because a lot of inside low kicks are going to be checked. So you're going like, okay, you're there, I'm here. You've locked yourself on one leg for a moment, so have I. Put my leg down behind me. Now I'm either going to, I'm going to punt you if you stand still. And if you come in, I'm going to knee you. And you can build off that with like boxing and shit. You know, everyone in J-Kick at the moment is obsessed with the switch step lead uppercut. So if you're southpaw, you take a little step back with your left foot to almost level and you step forward with your right foot. So a little switch step. But as you do it, you throw a right uppercut. So what was your rear hand is now your lead hand. And then you throw the high kick. And everyone in J-Kick is doing it at the moment. By J-Kick, I mean like Crush. And basically anywhere, it's all Japanese lads with punch perms or bleached blonde hair. But they're all obsessed with that at the moment, the switch step uppercut. And you could do that off your inside low kick. If you put your leg down behind you, just throw like the up jab, slide down the side and throw the left high kick. I will always like the sort of American kickboxing sort of style combination. I mean, they didn't really like low kicks in American kickboxing, but that sort of throw two kicks in rapid sequence, marching kicks. I will always like the inside low kick to right high kick. Because you can catch a lot of people sleeping. They go, oh, well, that's the kick throwing. Because everyone's so used to Dutch drilling where it's like punch, 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 low kick, punch, 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 low kick. That if you start with the low kick and then you throw another kick off it, people are like, what the fuck? Wasn't that how Holloway caught Volkanovski once with like a low kick, high kick? It's tricky to do, but if you keep your hands coiled and you throw a step up inside low kick, you can come down with a nice long jab afterwards. Bit of a specialist move. If you get good at it, it's useful. I say as someone who's not good at it. And you said building off faked inside low kicks. If you want to, like, not an inside low kicker very much, but Israel Adesanya does amazing work with step-up feints. He will step up and, like, pump his hip at the opponent. And then it's weird because it looks like he's doing an angry dance. But guys fall for it hook, line, and sinker because they're expecting the step-up left high kick. So he'll step up, pump his hip, and then he'll come back in with punches again. And he covers tons of distance doing it. So practice stepping up like with your right foot turned away, like you're going to do a kick, and then just stepping through with punches instead. Make tons of distance. It comes back around to the cross step that's so popular in various forms of point fighting. But yes, bring back the inside low kick. That's what I'm saying. Everyone should be playing with it. Cheers, James. Oi, Slacky. Love the podcast. I have a question. Do you have a list of favorite fighter accents? After Paul Craig's most recent fight, a lot of us casuals unlocked a level 99 Scottish accent we didn't know existed. I say this as a snooker fan who can mostly understand John Higgins. Who has your favourite slash weirdest slash most fun accents in combat sports? Can be from MMA, boxing, whatever. Cheers. From RK. Basically, thought this is a great question for this particular card because there's loads of fucking scousers on it. Darren Till has the most imitable accent in MMA, in my opinion. Fucking everyone and anyone. I'm not scared of no one. All these cunts gonna get it. I get it. There we go. Got it. Yes, get any scousers. Where was Ross Pearson from? Oh, he's from Tyne and Wear. But yeah, they used to have to subtitle him. People didn't know what the fuck he was saying. I think the things that I do most are like, I eaty, I trainy, and I sleepy. Weird voiced Brazilians. I back. Anderson had a very strange voice anyway. I think people really liked to imitate him. Chris Eubank, obviously the greatest. Can we have some parliamentary procedure here? But then I sound posh like Chris Eubank anyway, so I'm what Chris Eubank was going for. But Amanda Ribas has top 10 accent in MMA. She sounds like Borat. It's amazing.
Hello.
Everyone hates on Mackenzie Dern for hers. I'm always surprised when someone like Vicente Luque gets interviewed after the match and they're just like, they sound like a Cali dude. They sound like just a generic American dude. they don't have the accent at all. But yeah, it's got to be Scousers. It's such a fun accent to do. It's a very strange thing because I was up in Liverpool a few months ago and everyone talks to you like you think they're going to glass you, but they're really nice. The content of what they're saying is always lovely, but they just, something about the intonation of the accent makes it sound like they're really angry at you. Anyway, cheers, RK. I'll think of some more. I'll bring more impressions to the podcast. That's what it seems you're asking for. The people are begging for more Slacky impressions. Right, I don't know how long this will come out because this card had me scraping the barrel, but Jesus Christ, it's Smith versus Spann next week and they barely solidified the card. However, we are working our way towards that big pay-per-view. And, you know, we can always talk about some boxing or some boxing history or some fight history next week. So, yes, I am your boy, Jack Slack. You are my boy, and I will catch you on Monday. Cheers.